This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy 94.9.
Freshly dug Joycast.
And this is Doug Pollard bringing it to you. This hour we are digging deeper. Now, as someone said the other day, to lose one minister might seem unfortunate. To lose two is starting to look a bit suspicious. Yesterday, Defence Minister Senator John Faulkner quit, but he was beaten to the punch by my next guest, Finance Minister Lindsay Tanner, who announced his retirement almost before Julia Gillard's bottom touched the Prime Ministerial spot on the front bench. He joins me now for the next hour to play some of his favourite music and talk a bit about his life, and we'll maybe even slip in a little bit of politics. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Now, before we get started, what's your first piece of music? This Gypsy Queen?
Yes.
I've never heard of this one.
Well, you possibly might be younger than me and probably younger than the vast bulk of the people listening. They're probably younger than me, but Gypsy Queen is a song by an Australian band called Country Radio, written by a bloke called Greg Quill, that was a bit of a hit in Australia only in the mid-70s. Fantastic song, and listen to the lyrics in the second verse. They are some the best lyrics in any Australian song I've ever heard.
Okay, here we go.
Rising moon and silver road behind me.
This is Doug Pollard bringing it to you. This hour we're digging deeper with the member for Melbourne and current Federal Finance Minister Lindsay Tanner, who's basically on the home stretch now because he's not standing for election at the coming general election. And he's going to, as all politicians say, going to spend more time with his family. Except in Lindsay's case, I think he really means it. That was a lovely piece of music there. Nothing I'd ever heard before, basically because I wasn't in Australia at that time. Why did you pick that particular piece?
I love the lyrics, and particularly that second verse. To me, it's both sad and optimistic at the same time. It's very interesting words. And Greg Quill, who wrote the song, used to write for what was then the most popular young people's music magazine, Go Set. And he formed this band, Country Radio, which had another song that sort of got a bit of a minor run in the charts called Listen to the Children. But they were one of those classic mid-70s mm-hmm. sort of bands that, you know, the guys who played in it now are probably, you know, working on farms or driving taxis or whatever around the place.
Unless they were Americans, in which case they'd be touring Australia.
That's right. No, I think they were all Australians, and they were the kind of people too that were obviously wanted to play music because they loved music, not because they wanted to make lots of money. So I love that song.
Yeah, I was particularly struck by that line, wishing never can be believing, which I think would strike home for an awful lot of people.
Yes.
Let's go back to the beginning. I mean, we know where you are now, but you were born in East Gippsland in Orbost.
Correct.
What was that like way back then?
Well, it was a pretty basic place. I still love Orbost and that region, and because it's in Victorian terms very remote, people, it's the last sizeable town before you get to the New South Wales border. People tend not to know it. I grew up in a house where we didn't have proper electricity until I was about 7 years old. We used to have an old diesel generator, diesel-driven generator, in the butter factory that supplied electricity to the houses for lighting. So it was direct current electricity, and all it could power was lights. So we had an ice chest and a copper and a wood stove and that kind of thing. Of course, as a 6 or 7 year old, I was completely oblivious to any of this. But I do remember when we got the first fridge, and I can remember when the sewerage got put in and when natural gas got put on and so forth. So it was a pretty basic sort of place because it was so remote in Victorian terms, but it's a really fantastic part of the world, and I get back there every now and then. All my family's long since moved into other parts of Victoria, but it's a great part of the world.
What was your family like? Are you an only child? Are you one of many?
Oldest of four. My father, both my parents grew up in inner city Melbourne, And my father left school at 15 and went to work in an accountant's office and eventually did his accountancy qualifications at night school, all that kind of stuff, and got a job after they got married in this, the one accountancy practice in Orbost, and eventually bought the practice, and he and his partner became the, you know, the sole accountancy practice in the town. And midlife, he became a farmer. So he bought a farm on the banks of the Snowy River that was mostly growing beans. And so this is when I was in second year uni, so I used to go home in university holidays, and particularly the long summer holidays, and spend a lot of time working on that farm.
That's an interesting trajectory to go, you know, to study, to get a qualification, and then to go to the land after that. That seems to me to be a very Australian kind of trajectory.
Well, it's the thing, even though, you know, I've got various degrees and I've done all kinds of very city sorts of things, and I represent the ultimate city electorate, including the city of Melbourne, I'm still very much a country person at heart, and it took me years to adapt to moving to Melbourne and going to university. And I used to find myself very homesick after 2 or 3 months, even though being at university in the 70s was fantastic and there were all kinds of exciting things happening. I wanted to get home, and of course part of my retirement trajectory is that I'm now moved to the country, different part of country, Victoria. So I think it's one of those things, you know, people basically have it in their blood.
So all this time you've been in Canberra, you've been and Melbourne, you've been hankering to get back to the countryside, somewhere inside you.
Yes, in a word.
And now's the time to do it.
Well, that's right, and there's all kinds of factors involved. And as you implied in your intro, what you see is what you get with my retirement. I've been juggling for a number of years with kids, different marriages, all this kind of stuff, and you do get to a point where you've got to make some calls, and it's the right time to go. And I, being an AFL football fanatic, I look at these things. I have a football analogy for everything, and to me, it's a bit like the. Even though, of course, I don't wish to compare myself with Matthew Lloyd on any front, he is such a superstar. It's a bit like the dilemma that he faced when he chose to retire. When, you know, on any reckoning, he could have had another pretty decent season, but he chose to retire before that period of decline that inevitably happens in all careers sets in.
Well, in a way, there's never a good time, is there? There's always going to be some people who say you should have stayed longer, or you should have gone before, or whatever else. I mean, there's never the perfect time. It's got to be down to you.
Well, that's right, and you never know what would have happened.
No,
you know, and that's the thing. You just got
to. The thing is, you've got to say to yourself, okay, am I going to regret anything by staying rather than going? And I think you reach a point where you say to yourself, I'm going to have more regrets if I don't go.
I think that's right. And the thing is that when you, particularly in the situation I'm in, you face the prospect of the forthcoming election. The outcome for me over the next year could have been anything from, losing my seat, holding my seat, but Labor losing government, Labor retaining government, but losing my ministry, or being demoted or whatever, or getting promoted, or any conceivable kind of possibilities in there. You just never know.
So you've given yourself some certainty for the first time in quite a long time.
That's right.
Yeah, because is it a very uncertain profession, politics, isn't it? I mean, you're at the mercy of the electorate, you're at the mercy of your party, you never really know what's going to happen to you next.
Look, that's true, and one of the things that I think people unfairly criticise senior politicians for is when they resign and cause a by-election. It's a very unusual situation where you are, in effect, signing up for a 3-year contract where you don't know what the contract's going to involve. So you're signing up to something where you could be anything from a backbencher in opposition to a senior minister in government, and you don't know until after you've signed up and been elected what that's going to be. So I don't have a problem with people who have made the gamble that, you know, they give it another go, and if it doesn't turn out the way they expect, leaving and causing a by-election. I don't have a problem with that.
So you're not likely to be doing a Malcolm Turnbull, though. You're not likely to be changing your mind. coming back before the election and saying, I've had second thoughts.
Definitely not.
It's. Are you going to stay a member of the Labour Party?
I am, and I don't intend to be active in politics in a serious way, but I have a very strong belief that everything I've achieved in public life has only been able to occur because of the Labour Party, and so I owe a big debt to the Labour Party, and that means that at the very least I remain a member. I don't gratuitously criticise or publicly attack Labour governments or leading Labour figures, and I do my best to help in whatever small way I can.
Okay, I won't ask you anything about Julia then.
or anybody else.
Or Kevin, or anybody else.
Anybody else.
Fair enough. Let's have another piece of music here. You've got, good Lord, this is going back into my uni days. Deep Purple, Highway Star. What's this one about?
Well, you can see that there's a very strong 70s flavour to my choices today, and that's... not a great deal has happened in world music since about 1976, therefore I've reached back to my kind of youthful past. I'm being facetious, of course.
Of course.
But this is reaching into the unreconstructed sort of elements in my character. But I love Highway Star because if you think about that whole genre of hard rock, you know, crashing guitars and synthesizers and madness and so forth, this song is probably just about the all-time epitome of that genre, which I have a sneaking kind of love of.
Just like Question Time in Parliament, you make it sound. It's Highway Star, Deep Purple.
Two.
And this hour, we're digging deeper with Lindsay Tanner. That was a good bit of noise, that was.
Well described.
That was a good bit of noise. I can remember all those head-banging days at uni myself. And nobody was louder than Deep Purple.
I think that's probably right.
Nobody was ever louder than... I think they were famous for it at the time. Anyway, to get back to you, starting out in Orbosts, coming from a relatively poor background, although in Australian terms you were reasonably comfortable, I would venture to say. Let's talk a little bit about school, because I read somewhere that when you went to grammar school, and you did very well at grammar school, you actually didn't like the place very much.
I went to a boarding school in Sale called Gippsland Grammar School, and I was there for 6 years, and I got a very good academic education, so the school was tremendous as an academic institution, but the boarding house was run on kind of Dickensian lines, and we used to get regularly caned and for all kinds of trivial misdeeds, and it was very regimented and authoritarian and just nasty, frankly. So I did an interview with The Australian a couple of years ago where I just, in the middle of a two-hour rambling discussion, spent about a minute and talking about these things just in passing. And this ended up as the kind of key theme of the article, which was quite amusing. And the school, of course, freaked out a bit when they were plastered across a national newspaper's front page about what a bunch of brutal thugs they'd been 40 years ago. And so they invited me to go back and do a speech at their kind of speech night for the Year 12 kids. And I agreed, and this is the first time I'd been back for 35 years. And it was, what made it even more interesting is that the hall in which the speech was delivered and the dinner was held was actually a converted bit of the boarding house, what used to be the boarding house. And so I was actually where I'd slept for a period of time, and was now, and you could see the marks on the floor where the walls had been that they'd taken out and stuff. So that was quite interesting, but you know, it's a long time ago, and it was a different world. I think it's something that we've seen the debates about stolen generation, about kids who were taken from their families in the UK and brought out to Australia after the war. And often treated very badly, about kids being treated really badly in orphanages and so on. It's something that people haven't kind of noticed, is that the whole society treated children dreadfully in those times. You know, there was just a universal ethic that, you know, children were like bits of property and you could do whatever you liked to them, it didn't matter. And, you know, I've known girls as they were then, who've became pregnant while they weren't married, had babies, and the babies literally just taken off them 5 minutes later and put up for adoption, never seen again. So the whole society was incredibly brutal towards children in those days, and there are really extreme examples like the Stolen Generation.
Yeah, schools in particular, again, I can relate. I didn't go to boarding school, but I went to a grammar school which had a similar kind of ethos. It was very rigidly disciplinarian, a lot of physical punishment, a lot of ad hoc physical punishment as well. You know, there was an official system of punishments, and then there were a lot of unofficial punishments on top of that. Very, very regimented. But that was norm. That was the norm in those days. Even right up until, well, when did I leave school? 1968, 1970, thereabouts. Even up until then, the schools were like that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And they have changed enormously. People like my father would have said for the worse, but that's because I wouldn't join the cadet corps. You went on eventually to you started your career as an article clerk and a solicitor, and then you became an assistant to a Labour senator, Barney Cooney. Were you at that time already thinking in terms of going into politics?
Look, not really. It's one of those things where I was intensely political, and because I lobbed at Melbourne Uni in 1974, there was a heap of stuff going on. There was, you know, you had Watergate, you had all kind of, the Chilean coup was only months previously, had all kinds of incredible things happening around the world. The two elections in the UK that Labour won, the Whitlam government here, of course. And so I just immersed myself in all of that just instinctively. And at that age, you know, the future was next week. So the idea that I was planning a career in anything would have been ridiculous. I was just having fun and just doing all kinds of things. And what happened to me, I didn't even think about what I was going to do after university until, you know, towards the end of my second last year. And so I thought, I'm doing law, I better think about becoming a lawyer, and so I apply for articles, and I was lucky enough to get articles at Holding Redlich, which is a firm, an outstanding firm that I still have close connections with. And after I'd been there a few years, I'd become so involved in political things that I was literally leaving work sort of 5:36 and then having two meetings, like a 6 o'clock or a 6:30 meeting and an 8 o'clock meeting almost every night of the week. And it got to the stage where something had to give, and out of the blue, just as I was thinking about, well, you know, where am I heading? And I love being a lawyer, and I was representing injured workers with common law and workers' comp claims, but the pressures were getting to a point. And then out of the blue, Barney Cooney got, who I was on the administrative committee of the Labor Party with, got pre-selected for the Senate, and he asked me, do you know of any, you know, bright young things who might want to come and work for me once I start? And he was giving me a lift home from the admin committee on a Friday night, and I said, oh, yeah, no idea, but I'll let you know. And then I rang him up the Monday morning and said, I have got an idea, me. And so worked for him for a couple of years, and he is one of the great influences of my life and one of the most extraordinary people I've ever met, incredibly generous, warm-hearted, decent person who is the absolute antithesis of everything that people think politicians are, a guy who spent his entire life working for other people and doing things for other people and not being ambitious or nasty, and is somebody that we had 700 people at his farewell dinner, came from all over Victoria. You know, yet nobody in the wider community would be able to name him, but somebody who's made incredible contribution to public life and the Labor Party.
Obviously, never any chance of you being anywhere else except in the Labor Party.
Well, in retrospect, probably no, because I was a natural rebel, anti-authoritarian person. And people forget that at the time I got
in... So what happened?
Oh, yeah, well, exactly. Well, the Labor Party changed. At the time I got involved, the Labor Party had not been in office in Victoria in my lifetime, and it had been in office federally for 3 years of my lifetime. You know, so I was joining this hopeless bunch of quixotic noble crusaders that were pretty shambolic. And it was a very left-wing period in Australian politics too in the 70s. So the atmosphere was much more left or progressively oriented than it had been before that.
Yeah, because everything it seems to me, has shifted very much to the right since those days. The Labour Party in the UK, the Labour Party here, the whole political conversation generally has shifted, particularly in what I, in my terms, because I was in England at the time, I would call the Thatcher era, made that big sudden kind of ideological shift, and we've never actually started coming back the other way.
Look,
since.
I think it's more complex than that. That you've had a multiplicity of shifts, but they've been in both directions. On economic issues, what you've said is broadly correct. But I'd argue that's been driven by technological change more than anything else,
mm-hmm.
and affluence. But on social issues, it's the reverse. And if you think, for example, about the extraordinary strides that have been made in gay rights in both societies over that time, frankly, if you had gone back to the 1960s and said that in the UK you would have civil union mm-hmm. laws and that they would be accepted by both Labour and the Conservatives, people would have thought you'd
yes.
you know, you're taking something funny.
And you probably had.
And you probably had. But so that there are... It's in different areas. The environment, which has probably been the thing that's driven me in my political involvement more than most things. Our attitude, we've still got a long way to go, but I grew up in a society where basically the natural world was something to be conquered and exploited.
Mm.
And the idea that you needed to conserve or protect it just basically hardly occurred to anybody. So there have been huge shifts in a positive direction as well.
That begs the question to me, anyway, that a party like the Labour Party that was born, well, certainly in the UK, out of the trade union movement, basically, and about giving working people a voice as against the either the traditional ruling class or the economic ruling class, as it were, to put some weight on the other side of the scales, as it were. Whether Labour in its current form is really going to survive? Isn't it going to have to morph into something rather different?
Possibly, yes. You never quite know because, of course, as big structural shifts in society are occurring, you can't necessarily see or understand them. You can only kind of understand them in retrospect.
Mm.
The Labour Party has, particularly in its modern period, been a coalition between working people, the progressive middle class, and seriously disadvantaged groups in the community, such as Indigenous people.
Mm.
And that's been its broad political base. Now, what's happening now is that a lot of the progressive middle class, wrongly in my view, are defecting to the Greens. And so that coalition of interests and outlooks that Labor has been built on is fracturing. Where it will end up is anybody's guess. But people, I think, in assessing those things, ignore the fact that it's society changing that drives those things. It's not choices by individual political leaders. It's not betrayals. It's not the kind of flim-flam of politics that everybody gets excited about. The things that drive these changes are structural changes in our economy and our society.
So given that the old kind of set of understandings on which the Labour Party was founded are apparently fracturing, is there really an opportunity anymore for Labour to be genuinely progressive? Because it seems to have been the case, certainly with the UK Labour Party. I'm less familiar with the history of the Australian Labour Party, that the party has been forced almost to take a more, economically speaking at least, a more kind of right-wing viewpoint in order to, and in some social aspects as well, in order to be able to appeal to a majority of voters. And I think a lot of progressive people are drifting to the Greens because they're feeling left behind by Labour in that movement.
Well, look, I think the answer to your question is yes, there is plenty of opportunity, but if you take an absolutist sort of view that demands everything today, then you're always going to be disappointed because the nature of democracy is that you, by definition, have to get the acquiescence or support of something approximating a majority of the people in order to bring about change. That's a very difficult thing to do. That's Labour's job. The Greens don't have to worry about that. They can posture on the sidelines promising purity and absolutism, safe in the knowledge they never actually have to deliver anything, and delivering is the hard bit. But I'll just give you a couple of examples that I think I'm proud of, and I think the current government should be proud of, that are very significant things that get very little publicity. One is the increase in the base rate of the age pension. Now, that means that single-age pensioners, who are predominantly women, have got an increase in their weekly income of well over $30 a week. Now, if you are on the basic pension, full pension, that's a very significant thing, and that's a very significant improvement in your standard of living. That's the kind of thing that the Labor Party exists to do. We introduced the age pension over 100 years ago, and that big increase is a really, really important thing. Secondly, the elimination of discrimination on the basis of sexuality from legislation and immigration, taxation, social security and whatever. Now, there's more to be done, as you would know only too well. But that is nonetheless a step forward that I was debating with people about in the Labor caucus back in the early 90s, and people were kind of scratching their heads and going, oh, you know, what's all this about? Now, literally, within about 15 years, you've had a subsequent Labor government actually do it. So there's still lots of very worthwhile progressive things happening, but inevitably, because of how democracy works, there's back downs, there's compromises, there's things put on the shelf for future consideration. That's just the reality of life.
Yeah, but there's also a role, I think, for governments and for parties to actually lead on social change and to educate and advocate, which seems to be happen less nowadays than it used to.
Well, look, I think that's romanticising.
People don't stick their necks out much.
I think that's romanticising the past to a degree, but also I can rerun a little comedy routine that I often use, which is that I get lots of people coming into my office lobbying me to try and get the government or me or the Labor Party to support and promote a particular position. There's a simple formula. When they think they've got public opinion on their side, they talk about democracy. When they haven't, they talk about leadership. and it's amazing how consistent it is. Now, I would agree with you, but it has to be selective. You know, so you cannot expect any ostensibly progressive government to fight on every front. And so what in effect happens...
You've got to pick your battles.
Well, exactly. What in effect happens is that Labor governments do pick their battles. Some pick more than others, you know. And so really what you've got to do is look at the total picture and say, well, okay, you are taking a dive on this issue and that issue. Let's look at the total picture and say, how many worthwhile things are you actually doing, and how much effort are you making to do tough, courageous things? And, you know, obviously I'm biased, but I actually think that the record for the current government scrubs up pretty well on that front. And people should never forget that it ultimately, you know, the democracy means that any government, to a very significant degree, is a reflection of what's out there in the wider community.
Right. Let's take a deep breath at that point and have another piece of music. Now, oh dear, the Seekers, good Lord. I noticed, by the way, that they're coming back to town touring with André Rieu, of all things. I can't put that one together.
Yes, well, until
head.
I heard the André Rieu bit, I was actually thinking about going to see them.
Yeah, it put me off as well. Now, this is another one I don't know, The Bush Girl.
Well, this is a bit obscure. I mean, I, of course, as a country kid, grew up with the Seekers, and so I still love the... yeah, everything from Georgie Girl to Morning Town Ride to I'll Never Find Another You. And my little girls love Georgie Girl for some reason. They keep demanding that I play it. But I bought this a year or so ago, this compilation of their greatest hits, and there's this song that I'd never heard before called The Bush Girl, which I think is actually based on a Henry Lawson poem. And it is just a beautiful song that captures all of the sad realities of life in the Australian bush: isolation, loneliness, and the man who leaves his girlfriend to go out into the wider world, to go to London to look for excitement and opportunity, and she's stuck there by herself and left. So I think it's a beautiful song, and I've been really captivated by it since I've heard it.
Okay, The Seekers, The Bush Girl. Yeah, Doug Pollard here, and we're digging deeper this hour with the federal member for Melbourne, retiring member for Finance, Lindsay Tanner. That was a lovely song there. That was, as you say, that sort of loneliness, left behind, nostalgia thing. Sounds almost like the kind of thing that's driving you back to the bush.
There may be some connection.
Because you've talked about, you know, your love for the country and your wish to get back to it, and almost as if your parliamentary career and your time in Melbourne has been, in a sense, an aberration. Whereas it's actually been, you know, you've had a significant impact on this country. Did you ever want to go further up the ladder? Do you ever want to be Prime Minister?
Look, I think anybody with serious ambition going into politics has that in the back of their mind, as that'd be a really great thing to do. But my motivation was to become a senior minister in a Labor government, and that anything higher than that would really be in the lap of the gods. There is an incredible amount of luck involved in politics, mm-hmm. both good luck and bad luck, and very much it's the vicissitudes of fortune that govern what happens to you once you're up at that level. Also, obviously, individuals have some degree of control over their fates. Mm. So I've been fortunate to achieve my bottom line objective, be a senior player in a Labor government, and I've loved that, and I'm really proud of what I've been part of.
But time to go do something else.
Indeed.
Time to do something. I can't blame you. I mean, you've had a long run and you've done an awful lot, and you've been in one of the toughest jobs. You know, you've been running the razor gang, so to speak.
Yes,
everybody hates you.
That's right.
Because you're the one wielding the axe in there,
right,
aren't you? Which cannot be fun. But you've managed to stay, in many respects, kind of like above the fray. You know, you're not known as someone who leaks things. You're not known as someone who sort of plays factional games. You're not known as... I think you've got respect from all sides, is what I'm trying to say.
Look, I'd hope so. There's inevitably a tough element to politics, and I've been involved in some sort of fairly ugly things from time to time over the years, but essentially I've had the view since I got into Parliament that you can't both be a hero on the kind of machine politics front and in the policy sphere, mm. you know, that you really got to make a choice about which area you want to make your emphasis. And so I chose sort of policy and issues rather than being a factional operator or whatever. But I have done a bit of that over the years. And
I suppose you've had to, haven't you?
The battles in the union movement that I was involved with were about as ugly and nasty as you can get. So I've had a fair bit of experience of that kind of stuff. But I've generally chosen in the parliamentary sphere to focus on policy and issues, because I think you've got to be a bit selective about where you put your effort.
In other words, you can wade in there with your fists flying if you need to, but you'd rather not.
That's about right, yeah.
Yes.
That's very well put.
And people, and importantly, people know you can and will if it's absolutely necessary,
yes.
Which must help. Now, we haven't got a huge amount of time left, and I know there's a couple of pieces of music that you really, really want to play, and you wanted to talk about Elton John.
Yeah, well, I bought your song when it first came out would have been 1970, and I very quickly became a mad Elton John fan, and I'm even the proud owner of a copy of his very first album, which is called Empty Sky, which most of which is complete rubbish, and I have a strong view that he went downhill after about 1976, and he went very commercial and very kind of just formulaic. But his work from 1970 to about 75, 76 is just unbelievably good. And I play the piano, and I play a number of his pieces on the piano. And he is actually quite a creative composer and a brilliant musician, and he's got a great voice. Now, Tumbleweed Connection, I still think, is probably his best all-time album. And my favourite song on that is the very last song. It's called Burn Down the Mission. Unfortunately, it's about 6 minutes long, but it's still, I reckon, the best Elton John song of all time.
Well, we might not get all 6 minutes of it in, but let's have a listen to Elton John, Burning Down the Mission. Well, it turned out to be rather an unusual sort of digging deeper, because the guest is more interested in playing the music than doing the talking. But it also appeals to me as well, because he's picking things that date to my kind of era, when I used to buy music. Lindsay Tanner, it's been great talking to you today. I do wish you well in your retirement. You're obviously going to miss a bit of a bruising battle that you would have had you stayed, I think, for your seat, with the Greens nipping at your heels and all the rest of it. And I can't say as I blame you for saying, time to go home and you know, live down on the farm and get to know my family again.
Yes.
Because that's the big thing about politics, isn't it? There isn't really a lot of room for a personal life.
It is all consuming. There are no natural boundaries, and so there's always another meeting to go to, always another function, always another hand to shake, always another speech to give. So it is all consuming.
Even more so than being a doctor or a priest, I would think. Because even priests go on holidays nowadays, or so I'm told.
I suspect so, but there are probably some similarities.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Delighted to.
And good luck with the future. Now, you particularly wanted to play this particular track, your all-time favourite track from your all-time favourite band.
And my all-time favourite album. It is a song called Shine On You Crazy Diamond. Now, to avoid going way into the next segment, we're only going to play the last 5 or 6 minutes of the track, because the vocals start at about 8 and a bit minutes, which may mean that listeners are going to sleep before we actually get to the vocals.
I think we've sliced that off, haven't we, Nick?
I think there's a bit of judicious editing has gone on here.
Yes.
But this is my... this is very much, again, it's a 1970s thing, Pink Floyd...
from the Wish You Were Here album.
From Wish You Were Here, which was put out in 1975. And this song says it all. It's a retro on a guy called Sid Barrett, who was the initial creative genius of the group in their early days in the mid-60s, who took too many drugs and ended up kind of becoming dysfunctional, and they sacked him. But this was their kind of tribute to him.
Okay, well, thank you again, Lindsay. It's been great having you here for the hour. And no doubt we should be hearing words of wisdom from you once you're down on the farm. You might even write another book. You never know. Thank you for being my guest today.
Thanks very much, Doug.
This is your last choice. Shine On You Crazy Diamond from Pink Floyd.
Remember when you were young? You shone like the sun.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.